Hello, my name is Philip Mirotin, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Mirotin.
Each week on this show, we try to push the envelope a little farther in the long-running debate between science and religion. We know we have one world. We can look outside and say, yes, there's only one world out there. But then why do we have a world of spirit and a world of science? There must be a way to reconcile these two viewpoints. The source of the problem is not that hard to figure out, and more people, more and more writers are recognizing it. The problem is that science that we know of today is based upon materialism, the view in its extreme forms that only matter is real. Therefore, mind either does not exist or is an emergent property of matter, and neither does spirit exist in the material world. So if all that is real is matter, this in fact does not leave much room for spirituality, and in fact, there may be no room. And so there's the problem. A strict and consistent interpretation of scientific materialism leads to the death of spirit and the God delusion. This explains why many of the world's leading scientists are atheists and proud of it, such as Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, and Lawrence Krauss, among many others. But there's a deep problem here, because the spirit does not so easily go away. For example, over 80% of U.S. citizens believe in God or some universal spirit, despite, we might add, what the leading scientists are saying. And as we saw in last week's show with Russell Targ and some upcoming shows with other leading paranormal researchers, the paranormal shows that there is more to life, more to the world than may meet the eye in the scientific worldview. And there's also an extremely popular book out there, in fact, the best-selling book of all time, that has no place in the materialistic worldview, at least no place as a source of serious study. This book is called The Bible. So the topic of today's show is whether there is a way to reconcile the Bible with modern science. Now, I have my own ideas on how to do this, and those can be found in my book, Heaven at the End of Science, and the website of the same name. Our guest today, however, is Thomas Fusco, who is an independent researcher who has devoted nearly three decades in investigating the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomena, with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. In other words, he's trying to figure it all out like a lot of us, but Mr. Fusco has also written a book on the topic called Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. Now, this book does a lot of things, including proposing a new way to unite science and spirituality. And we're going to get into this a little bit, but first of all, welcome to the show, Thomas. How are you doing today?
Oh, great, Philip. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, first of all, you've spent a good part of your life writing this book, and you've become, I think, a student in this topic of science and spirituality. But what do you see as the chief obstacle in the quest to unite science and religion?
I think the main obstacle is one of a paradigm, of a way of looking at things. And what you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the program is very important when you talked about scientific materialism. This has been a very prominent view within the scientific community that everything is answerable by material explanations, that every material cause and effect in the universe that we can observe is the result of another material cause in that same universe. And in past decades and even centuries, this misnomer, this mistaken paradigm, in my opinion, was able to work because it seemed like every time that we would come up with an observation, we would eventually be able to find a material cause for it. But over the last couple of decades, Phillips, physics has come into an impasse in that they have literally run out of material to explain everything that is observable. We're not even talking about the supernatural or paranormal. We're talking about scientific physical observations. So in order to come up with these material explanations, we have come out with all kinds of strange theories in recent decades, like the multiverse and string theory and things like that, to try to explain this quandary, and none of them are able to overcome this problem.
Now you mentioned materialism, and that word comes up a lot, and those who aren't versed in the philosophical or scientific versions of materialism may associate it with an attachment to material things, which it also means. But how do you define materialism?
I from a scientific point of view, define it in the very same way that the field of science does, that everything is a cause and effect based on material, on physical substance, on matter, energy, and the geometry of space-time. And those elements together are everything that constitutes, quote-unquote, the material universe. And so in scientific materialism, every observation, every phenomena, every event has an explanation based on a cause that is involved with matter, energy, or the geometry of space-time. And that's what scientific materialism is.
Right, right. Now, I would add a couple other features to that definition. I would say, which aren't very controversial, by the way, I would say that another feature of materialism is that the world, the ultimate substance of the world is a material thing. It's associated with reductionism. So that's why I find it interesting to follow the God particle, the Higgs boson, which has got some press in the last year because of thousands of scientists searching for it in the Large Hadron Collider over there in Switzerland. But the God particle, to me, says that science is looking ultimately for God in a particle. The ultimate substance of the world is matter. And so the way you've put it, which I would agree with, we have a cosmological framework here where matter comes first, right? That's materialism, right? Matter comes first. And if there's spirit, it came out of matter or it doesn't exist. Would you agree with that, or do you take a different view of scientific materialism?
No, I would agree very much with what you're saying, in that everything has to have a material explanation. In recent decades, there's actually been attempts to go after spiritualism itself and try to discredit it, where in times past, science has pretty much left spirituality alone and just said, this doesn't fall under our category. We don't address it at all. But with certain theories that have been proposed, like the multiverse, which is another form of materialism, science is now beginning to launch a direct assault upon all elements of spirituality. Let's say by calling this Higgs boson a God particle, the actual philosophy that they have behind that is that they're going to say, this is what created the order in the universe that we couldn't explain before. And so they want to hold this up to all the ignorant, stupid masses that believe in something and say, here is the God that you have been worshiping.
Yeah, I would agree with your observation, and that's something that those who have not been observing the way our scientists are carrying on may have missed what's going on. If you go back 50, 100 years, the scientists respected the world of the spirit. Many of them were believers, such as you point out. Einstein did believe, I think, in Spinoza's God, which is nature is God. And then, of course, Newton spent more time writing about astrology and spirituality than he did about the mechanical universe. And we could even go back to just to Stephen Jay Gould, who had his the biology writer from Harvard, the late biology professor, who had that concept of there being really two different spheres, the sphere of science and the sphere of religion or spirituality. And when you get to these folks like Stephen Hawking, who recently has an article that caught my attention in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was, it says, why there is no heaven. And then, of course, we have Richard Dawkins with the God delusion, and we have Michael Shermer being skeptical about everything that he doesn't want to believe in. But so it's really a feature of our modern mindset, where I completely agree with you, where the scientists are intruding. Not only are they intruding, but they're completely rejecting anything that has a spiritual element to it. And so I think that's something that, to me, is bothersome, because scientists, I think, are going outside of their realm. They're pretending as if they're philosophers or spiritualists in denying that there is another reality. So this is very important, I think. Now, in terms of your own sort of stages in life, what event in your life or events led you to take this journey to try to figure it all out?
Well, for me, I had some experiences back in my late teens, mid-teens, and early 20s that were supernatural. And I don't really talk about them in detail on the radio anymore. People can find a description of some of those things on my website.
That's fine.
But a lot of people have had these kinds of experiences before, and for me, it caused me to call into question the picture of the universe that was taught to me in science. And I was one of those kind of young men who always needed to know why. And so for me, the compelling motivation was to find the answer to a mystery or the answer to a question. And this is what started me on this journey. And I explored all different types of fields of discipline. I explored paranormal research, religion. I explored the frontiers of science to what they were able to tell at that time, and scientific anomalies and observations. And I just felt that there is a model that has to encompass all these things.
You know, I think that there's something to be said for being open-minded and not being part of a school of thought. And it seems like that's what you are. I mean, you're not, I take it you do not have a degree in physics. So therefore, I think it helps not to have a guru or to be outside of the mainstream, because when you're inside the mainstream, my experience in talking to many people on this show and elsewhere is that it's harder to break out of the bag. It's harder to challenge the people that are writing your paycheck. I think it's very interesting that you sort of made your own way here. Now we talked about materialism as a concept, and you mentioned a couple features of our current cosmological framework. You mentioned the multiverse. I think you mentioned dark matter, and we had a little foray into the God particle. But what do you think are some of the features of the scientific worldview that are most questionable? Whether it's cosmology or evolution, what can you tell the listeners as an example of things that should be raising their eyebrows about whether materialism has all the answers?
Well, certainly when we were mentioning things like the God particle and dark matter, the most fundamental issue that we have in science today and have had it for some time has to do with universal order. And if we were to picture a clear glass box, for example, completely sealed, that's filled with common air, that's a mixture of all kinds of different gases, the atoms and molecules are colliding at incredible speeds with each other, constantly breaking themselves down any type of a structure that could form and keeping it a homogeneous mixture. And then if we could picture that suddenly, for some unknown, inexplicable reason, that all the oxygen atoms suddenly pull themselves out of the air in that box and collect themselves into one corner. And what we would have then is order. We, scientifically speaking, we have order and structure. And because of that, we would consider that a highly improbable state scientifically, because the actions of the gases and the molecules in it would break up any of these structures. It's almost an impossible situation, and yet that's exactly how the universe was formed. And so science has never had a good explanation. What they've tried to do is hang their hat on gravity. And gravity, from a scientific point of view, and what most people are not familiar with, is that gravity is what I call the elephant in the room, that they have passed on to the general public the idea that we are very confident about gravity and what it is by conveying the teaching of gravitational effect. We know what the effect of gravity is, but the underlying mystery is that we don't know what gravity is. We still can't demonstrate that it's actually a force. And until they can answer and link this gravity to a material explanation, and then in turn try to explain how this created universal order, they can't come up with a material explanation. But the illusion, the picture that they draw to the general public, is that, yes, this is exactly how it occurred.
And I think what you're saying is very important. And what we're seeing, I think, in the modern era, and I almost mean in the new millennium, is we have people like you and like me and others who are questioning these fundamental assumptions of science. There is a book that I cite to a lot. It's called I think it's called Physics for the Rest of Us, where he comes right out and says that science takes matter and the laws of nature as given. They assume that the laws of nature just are, that they're out there for some reason. This regularity, the forces, you mentioned order, which is really the fundamental problem. I would agree with that. But then you get down to, well, where did the order come from, and what caused the order? And there was a show that Stephen Hawking did last fall. I think it was on Nova or one of the or the Discovery Channel, one of those two, where he promoted his book, The Grand Design, and he talked about all these fancy cosmological things, including the multiverse. And after the show, there was a panel of quote-unquote experts who were critiquing him, including Paul Davies. And Paul Davies is the author of many, I think, very fine science books for the public, including God and the New Physics and the Mind of God. And Paul Davies said, well, that's fine, but he still has, but Hawking still hasn't explained where the laws of nature came from. Okay? And so So I guess what I'm saying is that we're in good company because scientists themselves, the ones that are more forthright, are asking the same question. We could, you know, they could be fancy with the theories and talk about, well, gravity sculpted the large-scale structure of the galaxies. That sounds really good, except when we ask the question, where did that sculpting power come from? And so that leads, and what you just mentioned about the box, I think that's very important because you're really saying that there's a violation of the second law of thermodynamics, right? The second law of thermodynamics says that all energy dissipates or moves into more random states. And
essentially what you're saying, Philip, is correct. Now, from a scientific viewpoint, this doesn't mean that such an improbable event couldn't occur.
Right.
But it's like what we talk about when we say extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And the idea that there is some sort of inherent order built into the universe, that it's self-explanatory, so to speak,
right,
that would create this highly improbable state, that's an extraordinary claim. And the extraordinary proof they're giving us is that they're blaming it on a substance called gravity that we don't even know what it is.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you could... the way I put it in my book is that gravity is a force that attracts. It doesn't have the mind of an artist. I mean, all the forces of nature either pull or attract. They don't have an aesthetic capability. So I would completely agree with you on that. Now you did a real nice job in your book of pointing out a couple of oddities from evolution. And why don't you talk about one of them that you think is interesting? And this is very important because there's a similar issue, I think, here with the origin of life and with evolution. You know, we tend to give so much respect to Darwin. To me, Darwin is sort of the high priest of science, and none of them question Darwin. But there's certain... features, there's many instances of evolution that brings into question, to me, Darwinianism. So why don't you mention one from your book or elsewhere that you think shows that there's something else going on other than just blind random laws?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I try to do, Philip, and you know with the approach that I used in the book, I tried the best that I could to stay away from philosophical and what would be considered today metaphysical or even religious explanations. I try to go into science's own boxing ring, so to speak, and to beat them using their own game and their own rules. So when we come to the quote-unquote theory of evolution, we've talked a lot, many people have talked about the different anomalies of evolution. But the ones that I feel are most significant is this, that any theory that describes a progression of events that lead to a particular observation, like evolution, it describes a progression of events that lead up to and explain the observations we make today of the living organisms that we have on the Earth. For that theory to be true, and for that theory to be sound, it has to have a starting point. Funny thing about evolution, though, it contains within itself no description on how life originally evolved from inanimate matter. Has no explanation. Therefore, it has no starting point. Therefore, evolution to me is like a statement that has been started in mid-sentence. It doesn't mean that the end of the sentence isn't accurate. It just means that A, the beginning of the sentence is missing, and B, without the beginning of that sentence, there is no coherent idea that is expressed by it. Mm. The other problem with evolution is from a scientific viewpoint. For a theory to be considered valid scientifically, it must be able to make predictions that are testable. Otherwise, it's just speculation or hypothesis or philosophy. A lot of rank-and-file people aren't familiar with this. So what I do is I challenge the theory of evolution to explain to me what a gray squirrel is going to look like 5 million years from now. If evolution was a sound scientific theory, it should be able to take its elements and explain to me exactly what that squirrel's going to look like, and it can't.
I know Richard Dawkins would not agree with you. I'm not so sure whether, I mean, I would agree on the testability side of things. And I also agree with your point about if you don't know where life began, then you really can't explain in a deep sense how it's progressing because you don't know the mechanism. But,
correct.
But I think Dawkins would say something like, since there's random variations in the genetic mutations, and since the vagaries of the environment can't be predicted, we have no idea what the squirrel's going to look like in 5 million years. I mean that, and I think that that's what they would say.
And my response to it, Philip, would be that the statement is only partially correct because anyone that uses the idea of this randomness, which has grown out of really like a quantum physical philosophy, and uses this as an explanation by which, well, since we can't ascertain anything, then we can't make such predictions. It's just impossible. And I say there's an inherent dishonesty, an inherent lie in that, that they know very well what they're saying. And that is that randomness occurs only within certain constraints. In other words, as you mentioned early on in the show, in a sense, the universe is put together in one way. When we look out at the distance, most distant parts that we can see of the universe, we can take the spectrum of light coming to us, and we can talk. We can understand certain things about the gravitational effect there. We can understand its velocity. We can understand what direction it's moving. And even the substance of which stars are made of, just by studying the spectrum of light. The reason that is possible is because the mathematics that are at work at the outer edges of the universe are the exact same as the mathematics that work here on our Earth. And therefore, we know through mathematics that the universe is put together in one way and in one way only. So there is certain variations within it, but there are certain constraints on it. We're not going to have a Jupiterian storm like the Jupiter spot appear on Earth, and we're not going to have a tropical hurricane appear in Alaska in the middle of winter. Yeah. It's just simply not going to happen.
Yeah, I have. This is from a little different angle. I think that evolution or natural selection, pick your term, is becoming the god of the gaps for modern science. It's unbelievable to me how many strange things that they see, and whether it's, the sex life of a bumblebee or whatever it is, strange animals that cooperate, like ants waging war against each other or building something. And you mentioned that a little bit in your book about how ants seem to cooperate. I mean, the modern evolutionists will say, well, that's natural selection. And to me, that's not much of an explanation. that is using a term that is so rich in meaning, much of it obscured. But I don't see a lot of difference many times between what the evolutionists are saying and what some of the orthodox religious folks are saying in terms of final causes.
That's a very good point, Philip. And this is another thing that the general public has kind of been, how would you say it, kind of been intentionally educated in a way not to see this for what it is that this idea of many aspects of evolution where they say, well, that's just natural selection, is very religious. It's right. Like saying, well, that, well, God just made it that way. That's right. Just the way it is.
Right.
The reality of the situation is that there isn't enough physical material to conclude from those observations with certitude that there is such a fixed order that's called natural selection that explains everything we see. One of the examples that I give, well, actually two in my book, when it comes to evolution, one of them has to do with flight. Now, evolution can't explain why animals even took to the air or how that was even possible for them to do it, since the predecessors of whatever flying creatures came into being had survived for millions of years and were perfectly attuned to their land-bound environment. All their needs were being met. If they weren't, whatever species evolved into a flying animal would not have survived long enough to go through that evolutionary process. There's actually no sound reason to explain from an evolutionary viewpoint why perfectly satisfied and happy and doing well land-bound creatures suddenly developed wings to fly in an air. Where are they going to make a home in the air? Where are they going to get food in the air? It doesn't make any sense. The other thing that I point out is deep into the oceans where the light doesn't from the sun doesn't get down, we see animals, creatures that have developed bioluminescence. Now they'll say, oh yes, natural selection. But the elephant in the room there is that living creatures, living flesh is what's supposed to evolve according to its natural environment. Here we have an environment where a physical substance, which is light, evolved. In other words, light is not a living thing. It's supposed to be the environment that creatures evolved to. But here we have examples where actually the fundamental substances of the environment itself are evolving through the living thing. It's evolution in reverse. They can't explain that.
I think that's a really good point. And what is important here to me is questioning these theories. And because science is based upon the notion that we are supposed to subject theories to critical examination both empirically and through reason. And the best theory, the winning theory, the truth ultimately comes out at the end. And to me, I completely agree that what we're doing here is we are questioning some of the theories of science. Well, if the theories are right, then they should withstand our questioning here. But there is nothing wrong with raising your hand and asking the question. And I think that another thing that irks me is that people like you, like me, and many others would be classified as intelligent designers right now. Okay, now just speaking, I'm speaking for myself because I don't think you're an intelligent designer. Although I know that you do rely upon the Bible, and we'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like it's an either or. You're either a scientist or you're a creationist. There is no, and this is the dialogue that our modern world gets us into when if you read so many of these books out there, another one being Bernard Hasch, The God Theory, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago, many books by other New Age thinkers that are classified as being strange when actually they are just trying to find some bridge, some transcendent bridge between between science and spirituality, and Ken Wilber would be another one. So let's so what I want to do here is have a transition, because we know that there's two steps to changing a mindset. There is deconstructing the current worldview, and then there is building another one. Because if you don't build another one, you know, it's fine to raise questions. There's nothing wrong with raising questions, and that's what we're doing, and I'm perfectly happy in questioning. But you have some thoughts about how to construct a different mindset, a different worldview theory, sort of in the ashes, right? After you've torn down materialism, well, what do we have left? So why don't you talk a little bit about what your thinking is on reconciling science and religion?
First, what I wanted to do was mention something that what you were just talking about, Philip, brought up an interesting point. And, you know, I'll get into what you were asking me about in a moment. But what another assumption that people operate under is that physics today is still in the search for truth. That's not the same as it was in the past. This is one of our problems, is that I try to explain to people every time I get to talk to them that there is a difference between the agenda of science and the agenda of scientists. Scientists are human beings, and they have their own agenda. And at one time, those were very closely linked. But in recent decades, we've seen a very sinister movement in the scientific community. And this is that they see the way the world is going, and that in the form of, let's say, what is normally called the intelligentsia, that they feel that they are the ones that need to lead mankind. They are the ones that are going to be able to know what the right thing is to do. In order to do that, they have to themselves not only, A, discredit any kind of a deity, but also set themselves up as the high priests of the new deity, which is the deity of science. And once we deify science, then its high priests are in command of the human race. This is why they're trying to discredit all areas of spirituality to an extent that they've never attacked it before. They're trying to kill God, and in doing so, then they will become the masters of the planet. So I think that's important for people to understand, like when they push these things about global warming, one of their agendas is definitely to create enough fear in the human population where they surrender God as their hope for the answer to their salvation and place it in the hands of scientists. You're the only ones that can save us now. And this is what they're trying to do. So I think it's important to point that out, that that's one of the factors that we deal with today.
Yeah, that's a interesting take on it. I don't know if I would go as far as you went. I think there's obviously some credibility to what you just said. I mean, it seems like every show I quote Max Planck, who said that science advances funeral by funeral. And I think a lot of it has to do with personal salvation, or just selfishness, where to get the jobs, to get the PhDs, the Nobel Prizes, you have to be indoctrinated into this current scientific orthodoxy. I would agree with you that these material scientists, is what I call them, in many instances believe that they are God. That would be my spin. Maybe we're saying the same thing.
I think the example I would use, and I believe it's in the old movie, The Ten Commandments, where when Moses had disappeared in the mountain, or I forget what it was, but one of the characters was played by Edgar G. Robinson, and he was a non-believer. You know, he was a conspirator, so to speak, with the Egyptians, and he taunted the people and said, hey, where's your God now?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the undercurrent in certain people in the scientific community
yeah.
is trying to lead humanity to, where they can be Edgar G. Robinson, say, hey, where's your God now?
Yeah.
Well, I got the answer for you.
Yeah. Well,
that's what they want.
Yeah. Well, and it takes, and I think it's going to take reason and to win the argument. This argument, if and I do think the argument's going to be won. I think that materialism is in its end days, and I've written on this where I do think that, and I don't know, everyone I ask, you know, they speak in terms of centuries or not in my lifetime, but materialism, which we know is not right. I mean, it's obviously wrong, and we haven't even talked about quantum theory yet, which disproves materialism on its face, right? But it's not going to be overturned by pounding the table, by pointing to statutes, or frankly, Thomas, by quoting the Bible. I think that materialism is going to be overturned by reason and by personal experience. That's my own view. But let's talk about your, because what's different about your book? First of all, it's very clear in sort of deconstructing many of these oddities and questionable features of modern science, cosmology, evolution. But you also have a unique way to sort of find a unity between the scientific world and the Bible. Do you want to talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. My premise is based on the fact that science and physics simply does not have a material explanation for everything that we observe. And it doesn't even have a material explanation for, as you were mentioning, about certain aspects of quantum physics, where they just say, well, this is just the way the universe is put together. Whereas Einstein, one of the greatest scientific thinkers who ever lived, disagreed with that. He said that, no. He said, quantum physics is impressive. He said, but I don't believe God plays dice. He also says in another place that there were laws, there has to be a lawgiver. And so he believed in an intrinsic order that existed over and above the physical observable universe of matter and energy, space and time, that we can at least in part see and experience. So for me, I took a look at a number of different anomalies, scientifically as well as paranormally. I would take a look at all the things that are, you know, that occur in a haunted house. Sure, there's people like Dr. Shermer who are in denial on that, and I do believe that there is a big difference between a skeptic and a denier.
Yeah.
And we need to make more efforts to try to make that distinction in our common language. But these things exist. They actually happen. And science has no explanation for them.
Right.
When we take a look again, talking very fundamentally about gravity, there are so many weird aspects to gravity that just simply don't fit in to the standard scientific model, that there must be a fundamental key to the way the universe is put together that's based on that gravity. And if it doesn't have a material explanation, then it must have an immaterial explanation, something what I call superphysical, extraphysical, or more specifically in the terms of my book, supergeometric. So if we accept the idea that there is an order, or what I say sometimes more specifically, a body of information that exists outside of space and time. And that body of information or order determines the nature and the structures and the behavior of everything that we observe in the physical universe, then that would answer a lot of different questions. what we would only need then is a means by which that information can enter into our space-time and materialize. And my conceptual key to that is to come up with a completely different paradigm of gravity, in that the traditional material explanation is physical mass bends the space around it, which creates a gravitational field. But we don't have the physical proof for that model. In fact, our observations tell us the opposite, that gravity is not a force, and that we see gravitational lensing in the bending of space in areas in the universe where there is no adjacent matter. So my paradigm turns it on its head. What I say is this. I follow, to an extent, what physicist Theodore Calusa came to the conclusion, that there is something outside of our physical world that actually has an effect on the fabric of space-time, which causes it to bend. Now, that bending creates a gravitational field, and within that well is where information coming from outside of space-time materializes. So, in other words, since we observe, everywhere we observe mass, we observe the bending of space, but 90% of the places in the universe where we observe the bending of space, we do not observe mass. Then the natural formula, the mathematical conclusion is that mass is not the cause and the bending of space is the effect. It's the bending of space-time that's the cause and mass is the effect.
Okay. So one of the elements I got from your discussion of superphysical or supergeometry in your book, and I could be wrong, but for example, when you look at the paranormal, to use a more simple example, when you look at something like clairvoyance, and last week we had one of the leading thinkers in remote viewing on the show, Russell Targ, who, for example, worked with the folks that found where Patricia Hearst was kidnapped back in the 70s, and has perfected this art of remote viewing. Well, if remote viewing is true, which it looks like it is, then there is some way for information to be conveyed outside of the normal physical means, right? I mean, in other words, there weren't little particles going back and forth between the remote viewer and Patricia Hearst. There's some web there. So I view the supergeometry as sort of an invisible web. That's the way I was trying to understand it. Is that accurate? Am I sort of an invisible web that is connected?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And, of course, the Bible talks about that as the wisdom or the word of God and tells us a lot of characteristics about it, which has helped me kind of understand exactly what was going on and led me to part of the missing equation in all of this philosophizing. Because this idea is, you know, Philip, about this exterior body collection of information, and that it can travel outside of space-time and be stored outside of space-time, is not in itself new. The idea was to take it a step further and to talk about how that information materializes. So let's say, for example, we're talking about a telepathic contact. Let's say in this example, someone was able to telepathically connect with Patty Hearst, so to speak.
Okay.
Now, we know from a physical point of view that thought is expressed or materialized in the human brain in an electrochemical form. Now, the information in a telepathic communication, the thought itself, which is the information, gets transmitted in a way that is not through a physical conduit. So it must be extraphysical, outside of space-time. That thought becomes separated from the electrochemical representation of it in a human brain, and yet the thought still remains intact without the electrochemical component. It travels through wherever it does, excuse me, outside of space-time, enters into another brain, and from that information itself, suddenly the electrochemical constituents of that thought materializes in that second brain. And so we know that the electrochemical components of the thought aren't transported from the one brain to the other like Star Trek.
Right.
So here we have in the human brain an example of the materialization of non-material or non-physical or spiritual, whatever you want to call it, of information is actually being materialized within the arena of the human brain. And that has to reflect in some way how the universe is put together.
Well, you have to, so you, it's sort of like, from what you just said, it sounds as if you go from a material substrate, which would be the brain, then you have a thought which has a connection to the material substrate, according to what you said. Now the thought leaves that material substrate and then like rematerializes. Is that sort of what you just said? So therefore the path that it took must therefore be something beyond the physical.
That's correct. That's because right. There is no way for the physical constituents of that thought in the biological brain, which is the electrical and chemical impulses exchanged within the neurons,
right.
There is no physical way for those physical components of that thought to transport Star Trek style
right.
into another human brain.
Right.
So it must only be the information itself that, the information has to exist separately from its material components. And number two, has to be able to travel through a conduit that doesn't use any physical element within space or time as a conduit, like a light beam or an electrical cable. And it enters into the other mind, and as soon as that pattern, enters into the other mind, then the electrochemical components, the corresponding constituents of that thought, suddenly materialize inside of that second mind. So it now has both the original thought and the electrochemical components of that thought.
Okay, well there's a pretty obvious question sitting out here that I'm going to ask you, because is there a distinction, here it comes, is there a distinction between the super geometric web, let's call it a web, and what others would call the cosmic consciousness? And there's other words it's called, but let me use the word is there a distinction between the two?
Not much.
Okay.
In other words, it's a distinction of one of shading,
right,
and one of being a little bit more, in my opinion, my definition of it is a little bit more detailed and exacting than what has come before. But in general, no. It dates all the way back to Plato's Forms.
Right.
David Bohm's Implicate Order. It's the same concept.
Right. Because this is another way. If we're going to have a convergence, and we need a convergence of thinking, if there is going to be one theory, everyone's going to be basically promoting the same theory, if that theory is the right one at the end of the day, maybe it'll be thousands of years from now, but whatever. And maybe it's like that story where, which I don't like, but I'll say it's a story about in the dark, people are groping around and there's an elephant and they feel different parts, whatever. But there's different, so we have all sorts of different elephant metaphors here. We have the elephant in the room, we have the elephant with the different people in the dark. So we're covering all the elephant metaphors today. But if you look at, for example, Aldous Huxley's The Perennial Philosophy, and then you have Hinduism, and then you've got like Hegel, you have all sorts of people, and my own book is based upon there being one consciousness. If you've got sort of people saying a very similar thing, they're calling it different names, because to me, the obvious way to explain the paranormal is if there is one underlying substrate. And that is not an original thought, as you point out. I mean, I think we can go back to, you know, the early Indian philosophers were the first to articulate this. That this is what the Upanishads is all about. And so it's good to know that. And frankly, Thomas, I think this is good for you and for me. And that what you're saying is not like a completely new theory. It's basically being a little bit more, how can I put this, more scientific about an old theory, or reframing it into a different language. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I would say that in a broad sense, that's true, except that there are aspects of my theory that are truly revolutionary,
right,
and have never been actually expressed or drawn out before. Because in all of these ideas that you're talking about that go back a long way about this order or matrix that exists outside of space-time, cosmic mind, whatever you want, none have ever defied or defined a scientifically reasonable mechanism by which that information materializes in our physical universe.
But we're just about to end here. So I want to ask you, what is it in your theory that explains the materialization?
What explains it is the superphysical bending of space that creates a space-time depression, what I call a differential field bubble, which is essentially the curved space around the object, but without an object inside of it, and to explain how that can come into being. And then material can come from superphysical information once the flow of that information is decelerated to the speed of light and below. As soon as it crests the barrier of light and enters into a depression of space-time, it begins to materialize according to the order of that information.
But,
and that's what's different than what's ever has come before.
Okay, but what you just said, though, to me, it sounds like it is a theory, correct? It's a theory, right?
But it's a scientific theory.
Yeah, but it's a theory, but therefore it would have to be tested.
Yes, and we already have at least four different valid tests that have resulted in the predictions that this theory makes. We're actually about a year or two, myself and a gentleman named David Roundtree, are about a year or two away from actually submitting a paper to the scientific community on this.
Okay, well that sounds like it's really going to be good reading. Now, I want the listeners to, if you want to learn more about Thomas Fusco's ideas, they're in his book Behind the Cosmic Veil. That's V-E-I-L, A New Vision of Reality, Merging Science, the Spiritual, and the Supernatural. And I believe, Thomas, why don't you give your website to the listeners?
Yes, the website, you can find my media appearances and all my related articles, my blog, and the links to the book and how to get the book at www.cosmicveil, again, that's spelled V-E-I-L, cosmicveil.com.
So what does this all mean? It means that materialism, this view of the world where all that exists is mindless, lifeless matter, is in jeopardy. But in order to tear down this field of thought, this view of the world called materialism, we're going to need another theory to take its place. And the only way that's going to happen is that if somebody or some group of people comes up with a better view, a more explanatory view, that is rational, that is testable, and that is strong enough to convince those who are thought leaders to think of the world in different ways. This is Philip Miriton. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Miriton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heaven@theendofscience.com.